Support for the World's Podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
Obama's immigration plans hit a wall today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A Supreme Court stalemate leaves President Obama's executive actions on immigration in limbo. We'll hear from one undocumented woman who's directly affected.
It takes us back to the same kind of fight we have been doing throughout so many years to be recognized as human beings in this country.
Also, U.S. lawmakers live streaming a protest from inside the chamber. It happened recently in Turkey, too.
And the opposition MP just pulled out her phone and started live streaming and got huge viewership.
Plus, what happened when Icelanders were asked to tweet their offerings to Thor?
We got hundreds of people tweeting back at us with pictures of their defrosting pork chops and and shots of whiskey.
All in the name of soccer. Those stories today on The World. Thank you for being here. Let's start today with some big news out of Washington. President Barack Obama's efforts to change immigration policy through executive action got a major setback. The U.S. Supreme Court split 4-4 over Obama's attempt to protect up to 5 million illegal immigrants from deportation and make them eligible for work permits. And the tie means the president's actions remain blocked. A frustrated Obama looked ahead to November and the elections.
We're going to have to make a decision about whether we are a people who tolerate the hypocrisy of a system where the workers who pick our fruit or make our beds never have the chance to get right with the law, or whether we're going to give them a chance, just like our forebears had a chance, to take responsibility and give their kids a better future.
We'll get into the nuts and bolts of the Supreme Court's decision in a couple of minutes. But first, I want to get reaction from someone directly affected by the court's decision. Maru Villapando lives in Bellingham, Washington. She's been campaigning to get rights for undocumented immigrants like herself.
Well, first, I was not surprised. I expected that that could be a possibility where they could be split and take us back to the lower court, which in reality for us means this is not going to move. On the other hand, I had a little bit of hope that they would do the right thing and would allow for the deferred actions to move ahead. So I was, at the same time as I was not surprised, I was really angry.
Right. So I just tell me a little bit more about your own background. When and how did you come to the U.S.?
Well, I came to the U.S. Back in 1992. I used to go back and forth with my visa as a tourist. And then I stayed in 1994 after the implementation of NAFTA and the assassination of the official presidential candidate, Colosio. At that time, I was trying to be involved in politics and I was trying to survive. And both the combination of NAFTA and the killing of this presidential candidate made me realize that living in my country was impossible.
And that's Mexico, just to be clear.
Right. This is in Mexico. So I decided to not go back because it was impossible for me. So I've been in the country for over 20 years. And the last time I was able to see my family was precisely 20 years ago.
So what would happen if you went back to Mexico? You'd not be able to come back to the U.S.?
Well, the most likely scenario is that as I was trying to leave the country, I would be placed in detention. Regardless of me saying, hey, I'm going back to my country, I would be placed in detention. So Immigration Customs Enforcement can meet their daily quota of 34,000 people detained throughout the nation any given day. And then I would be deported and I wouldn't be allowed to come back for at least 10 years, depending on what the deportation proceeding will be.
Now, the Supreme Court tie vote today addressed DAPA, the Deferred Action for Parents of Americans and Lawful Permanent Residents. And you're eligible for DAPA, correct? Because your daughter was born here.
That's right. My daughter was born in 1997. She's a U.S. citizen. And me, along with many, many others, could have been protected from deportation proceeding. But that's not the case now.
Yeah. So how will this ruling actually affect you and your family?
Well, it takes us back to what we have been living for all these years, which for us, it means we have to know each other's location throughout the day to ensure that we haven't been detained by ICE or, you know, just contact with the police also for us equalizes deportation proceedings. So we constantly text each other to know where we are at. Also, it means we cannot travel outside the United States. It means even if somebody in my family gets sick or somebody dies, which has happened, I can go and I need to stay in the country. So I'm pretty much stuck and not able to travel when it's necessary. But it takes us back to the same kind of fight we have been doing throughout so many years to be recognized as human beings in this country.
Obama today spoke of the hypocrisy of letting the people who pick our fruit and make our beds not having the ability to get right with the law. I suspect you know a few of those people in your activist work.
I know a lot of them. And here in Washington State, the wealth of the state is based on the agricultural industry. And that means those hands that picked our fruits, and then we have really cheap products to eat every day. And it is a hypocrisy, but he can fix it. He's still the president. He's still the boss of Homeland Security, and he can end deportations for now. He can call a moratorium. He can still do it.
Maru Villalpando in Bellingham, Washington, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's dig in a bit now on the Supreme Court's decision, a 4-4 tie. The court would normally have had 9 members, making a tie unlikely. But with the death of Justice Antonin Scalia in February and Republicans in the Senate refusing to vote on Obama's nominee to replace him, here we are. Muzaffer Shishti is with the Migration Policy Institute at New York University. There are a lot of acronyms in this story, DACA, DAPA. Can you spell it out for us? What are the practical implications of the court's ruling?
So the DACA was an executive action that was implemented in 2012, which affects basically young people who arrived in the country when they were younger than 16 and have lived here since then and have matriculated from high school or have a job. And they are not affected by this program. That program remains intact. This executive action would have expanded that earlier DACA program by giving it to a larger number of similarly arriving kids or kids who had arrived here before they were 16. But more importantly, it would also have given deferred action to a group of adults who are parents of U.S. citizens who had lived here for a long period of time and had met other requirements of the executive action guidelines.
A tie would likely not have happened if an Obama Supreme Court nominee had gone through the nomination process and gotten approved. Could, for example, a President Trump, who's already expressed his indignation for immigrants, just upend DACA entirely?
You could argue either way. I mean, if Justice Scalia had not passed on, it's quite likely that this would have been a 5-4 decision. So that would have been much worse an outcome for the administration than the 4-4 tie, because the 5-4 decision would have set a precedent. So in many ways, it is the second worst thing that could have happened for the Obama administration. So there's a possibility that in the future, whichever president gets elected in November, they could possibly reissue an executive action like this with slight modification. And that may be challenged. And even if it's challenged, if it lands up at the Supreme Court, by then hopefully there is a 9th justice who may be a 5th vote for upholding the president's authority to do an executive action like this.
But do you reckon that today's ruling at the Supreme Court effectively pushes this issue to the next president?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, whichever way the Supreme Court would have ruled today, this executive action and certainly its future was going to be determined by the next administration for the simple logic that there just wasn't enough time left in this administration to implement this program in a robust way. And since it's been blocked now, the decision will rest with the next administration, whether they want to reissue an executive action or if there's Trump presidency. We don't expect they will reissue an executive action, but there is then a possibility that they may rescind the original DACA, which has been in effect for the last 4 years.
So finally, how could this ruling today affect the presidential election, especially the mobilization of the Latino vote?
That's always the issue in electoral politics. Immigration plays a very effective role, at least recently, in our electoral politics. There are a lot of people who argue that granting DACA in 2012, potentially 1.5 million people, that energized the Latino electorate all over the country and was responsible for the significant advantage it gave the president, at least in three or four toss-up states in the country. I think Democrats will be busy beginning this afternoon to claim that this is a politically motivated decision and that we must change the politics in this country on this issue and therefore appeal to the Latino base to come up and be energized to vote. And I think that is probably going to affect at least the elections in some of the toss-up states.
Muzaffar Shishti with the Migration Policy Institute at New York University. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to stay in Washington for one more story, one some of you maybe even watched last night. With TV cameras rolling, congressional Democrats staged a sit-in throughout the night and into this morning. They were demanding stricter gun control legislation in the wake of the recent attacks in Orlando. Then the Republicans pulled the plug on the cameras, and things got testy.
Time for a real debate on these issues.
Just a vote.
With equal time talking about radical Islam. Radical Islam!
With the cameras off, Democrats used their smartphones to stream the sit-in on social media platforms like Periscope and Facebook. Zeynep Tüfekci is an associate professor at the University of North Carolina. She's originally from Turkey, and we often turn to her for her unique perspective on social media and its intersection with politics and society. Zeynep, I honestly can't believe politicians and lawmakers in other countries haven't videoed and streamed their proceedings before.
Well, they have, actually. that's the funny part about it, is that this makes the U.S. look like other countries I've been familiar with. For example, in Turkey, we had a very similar incident when official camera feeds were cut off during a very contentious debate. And the opposition MP just pulled out her phone and started live streaming and got huge viewership. So the idea of using your own personal device to stream when traditional mass media outlet won't cover you has been around for a while, but it's still striking to see U.S. senators and U.S. congresspeople using that as a tactic.
Do we know why C-SPAN was not rolling on any of this?
Because the C-SPAN relies on the congressional cameras, which were cut off. Because when the House goes into session and when it adjourns, the cameras by rule go off.
Got it.
So there was no camera rolling. I mean, the rules of how Congress operates are obviously not designed to promote the dissemination of information about a protest by the legislatures.
Which makes Periscope and Facebook Live really compelling alternatives to, you know, those cameras that go dark when the session shut down. Periscope, Facebook Live, I suspect these are just a couple of social media tools that would have worked well in this context.
Yes, I saw this one on Twitter most, but Facebook Live is another alternative that's been showing up. And I've seen, for example, to give more Turkey examples, one of the opposition party leaders has been unable to get on mass media since about the last election, a year. Complicated story, but he's taken to holding press conferences of sorts with the people on Facebook Live. And I've seen him get 250,000, 500,000 viewers.
Wow.
On just Facebook.
Democracy in the palm of your hand.
Definitely broadcast in the palm of your hand. So it's definitely lowered the gatekeeping power of official cameras on whether or not something gets the spotlight.
So if it's broadcast in the palm of your hand and not necessarily democracy yet anyway, how much do you think what we saw on Capitol Hill with this sit-in on gun legislation, how much do you think that's going to change the conversation and the people who were reached on those Periscope and Facebook Live feeds?
That's a good question. And it obviously partially depends on whether people who are moved by this topic, and it's a very important topic for sure, show up at the polls and elect too, because those lawmakers can get attention. But, you know, we are a democracy and our electoral system may be sputtering and not working, but it's the only one we got. Social media is great for getting attention to a cause, but if there's no follow-up through other means, and that includes elections and that includes other actions, it can fizzle.
Our friend Zeynep Tüfekci at the University of North Carolina, thank you.
Thank you.
You are with The World.
Support for the World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the evolution of consumer preferences to the reasons for price swings in the oil market, tune into Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
This week, we're exploring the challenges of sea level rise. Yesterday, we took you to the Netherlands. Today, we're headed to Norfolk, Virginia, where there's one high-profile place that's especially at risk.
Norfolk Naval Station is the biggest naval installation, not just in the United States, but in the world. And the land it is built on is literally sinking.
That was U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in Norfolk last fall to call for action on climate change, not just for the environment, but for national security and military readiness.
By fueling extreme weather events, undermining our military readiness, exacerbating conflicts around the world, climate change is a threat to the security of the United States.
The so-called threat multiplier. We sent the world's Carolyn Beeler to Norfolk recently. She found that the Navy is trying to stay ahead of rising seas, but they can't do it alone.
That's right, Marco. I toured the Norfolk Naval Base with Captain Pat Rios, who was the head engineer for the Navy's Mid-Atlantic region. The day I visited, the USS Cole was getting worked on at its dock. And down the shoreline, I could see the hulking cruisers and destroyers and aircraft carriers of the Atlantic Fleet. Rios told me those are not what the Navy is worried about.
It's not the boats that are the issue. They're designed to be in water. The ships have to come to this base to maintain, to train, to rest their crews, to get their logistics done. So the issue with sea level rise is less about the ship. It's more about the system that supports the ship.
The base sits on more than 6,000 acres in southern Virginia, near where the Chesapeake Bay meets the Atlantic Ocean. A combination of sinking land and rising water here means that relative sea level may be up to 6 feet higher by the end of the century. Rios says the support system here is already vulnerable. He showed me at an empty dock.
Normally there are submarines here. Here you see kind of your standard pier. And you see there's utility systems.
Thick cables and pipes for water, sewage, and electricity run under the pier, open to the water below.
And so as the tide rises or there's surge, then all those electrical lines, all these utility systems would be underwater.
Actually, that already happens every couple of months. And when it does, the base has to shut off the utilities to docked submarines and ships. That, in turn, delays maintenance work, part of the readiness problem that Kerry talked about. On my tour of the base, Rios pointed out other vulnerabilities. A parking lot that was underwater during a recent storm, flood-prone housing and maintenance buildings.
So you could see how if, you know, there were a cataclysmic event, we kind of have everything in one spot.
Today, the Navy has to account for sea level rise in its planning. Rios showed me a relatively new double-decker pier that has utility cables running high above the water. But back at his office, he told me what his colleagues can do on the base itself is only part of the solution.
I can make this base impervious to sea level rise. I'm an engineer, and I believe that all things are doable. But this base is not an island.
The naval station relies heavily on neighboring cities for basic services, not to mention access to the base for many of its nearly 70,000 employees.
There's a significant connective tissue between us and the outlying communities, and so we have to work together to address sea level rise.
That's why the Department of Defense has launched a planning process with the neighboring cities of Norfolk and Virginia Beach. Norfolk Deputy City Manager Ron Williams says they'll begin by assessing how rising waters will affect those most necessary services.
The very basics. How do they get electricity? Where does their water come from? How do the sailors get to the base?
The new regional approach to planning for sea level rise incorporates principles that Dutch advisors to Norfolk have been preaching in their work with the city. It's a big step forward, but this collaboration is also fraught with challenges, starting with the basic question of how much sea level rise to plan for.
It's easy to look at the high curve and say, okay, let's plan for worst case.
Ann Phillips is a retired Navy officer who was involved in the effort.
Well, worst case means there's 8 feet of water at around the turn of the century.
The base might want to plan for that worst case, but Phillips says surrounding cities don't want to freak out waterfront residents with predictions that may not come true.
The most valuable property here is waterfront, of course. And so there's a real challenge there.
Phillips is working with more than a dozen local cities and towns to develop guidelines for dealing with challenges like these. And the challenges are huge. But if they can be overcome, the hope is this process in Norfolk may help Navy bases and their neighbors in places like Guam, Japan, and Italy better prepare for sea level rise.
So this is the backside of the base. It's all Willoughby Bay here.
Back on my tour of the Norfolk base, Captain Rios points out that the concentration of ships and planes and people right at this sea level rise hotspot means the stakes are very high here.
This is a priceless national asset that, if you ask me, is irreplaceable.
A priceless national asset with a global reach that Rios says we'd better figure out how to protect.
Carolyn Beeler reporting there from Norfolk, Virginia, and she joins me now in the studio here in Boston. So you say the pilot project in Norfolk is meant to be a kind of template for other naval bases. What do we know about how at-risk naval bases abroad are to rising seas?
Marco, we really know the most about Norfolk. Foreign bases have been less studied. I spoke to the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Dennis McGinn, about this, and this is what he told me.
We don't have that granular information to say, okay, for this naval station in Guam or Japan or Italy, it's going to be 2057 when we have to have our piers raised by 2 meters. We're not at that level of granularity now. As we learn more, as climate models get better, we will learn lessons and we'll apply them.
But from the 10,000-foot view, a recent study found that about half of U.S. naval installations, which represent a worth of about $100 billion, could be damaged if sea levels rise just a meter.
So it sounds like the Navy is just starting to plan for sea level rise. How much time do they actually have?
Well, there is some time. This is a relatively slow-moving phenomenon. But Assistant Secretary McGinn, again, says over the next century or so, the Navy's going to have to start making some really tough decisions.
Do we want to put in some sort of a seawall, some sort of a barrier, or do we need to actually move to another location?
So as you can hear, unlike some leaders on Capitol Hill who are still sort of debating about whether man-made climate change is happening, the Department of Defense is asking, what are we going to do about it?
The world's Carolyn Beeler, who will be back tomorrow on air to talk about how Norfolk is trying to become the Netherlands of the U.S. Looking forward to that. Carolyn, thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
A quick look ahead now to a story we'll have for you after the break. Just listen to this madness. Want to know what he's screaming about and in what language? I already know. You got to stick around and find out. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, one voter's unique view on the Brexit referendum in the UK.
I've got so many identities. I'm British, I'm Scottish, and I'm European. And I'm a woman, and I'm a stand-up comedian, and I'm a Glaswegian. So it's all there.
Scottish comedian Janie Godley gives us her take on the Brexit. That's coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Take your mind back to when David Bowie died. While he was alive, we knew he was huge, but with his death, we suddenly saw what he meant to so many, many people. The same goes for the death, the murder of singer Amjad Sabri in Pakistan yesterday. He was on his way to a performance when he was killed by two gunmen. Amjad Sabri was 45 years old. He was known for his performances of Qawwali, a form of devotional music closely tied to the Sufi sect of Islam. The funeral for Amjad Sabri took place today in Karachi. The BBC's Shaima Khalil in Islamabad has been seeing the grief among Pakistanis.
It looked like just tens of thousands of people flooded the streets of Karachi today expressing everything from shock to deep sadness, grief, and anger at the loss of one of the most famous and beloved singers in Pakistan. You saw men, women, even children, all overcome by emotion. People sharing some of his songs, his kawals, the Sufi music online, speaking about their memories with him, growing up with his voice, growing up with, you know, the family of the Sabris who've really brought such beautiful, beautiful music to Pakistan.
Who killed him, Shaima? Any claims of responsibility?
Well, we do have reports that a group linked to the Pakistani Taliban have claimed responsibility for the attack. We understand that they said they killed him for blasphemy. Mainly, it's because Sufi music is seen by extremists and Sunni hardliners as heretical. They don't see it as Islamic, and they time and time again have condemned Sufi musicians. And we know that there have been many occasions in which Sufi shrines have actually been attacked. People here are quite angry and frustrated at the government and the security forces. And they're saying, look, you know, why did he have to go that way? And why is it that after every major attack, we hear the exact same thing, but nothing changes?
Well, you noted today on Twitter that Pakistani newspapers have been critical of the government security forces in relation
Indeed.
To this killing. What are those newspapers saying?
I'll give you an example. So this is one from The Nation: terrorists silence a Sufi, Daily Times: the last Sabri silenced. And then from Pakistan Today, it says Amjad Sabri is dead, but so is the NAP. And NAP, it stands for the National Action Plan. And this is the plan that happened after the horrific Peshawar school attack. If you remember, 132 mm-hmm. children were massacred at the time, and there was a huge uproar really all over the country. And at that time, the government came out with a number of recommendations vowing that they were going to push back on militants, that they were going to monitor madrasas or seminaries, that they're going to keep all of this in check. But unfortunately, after this attack, we had a number of major attacks, including the blast of Lahore just last Easter. Mm. The security forces need to do a lot more to keep safety and security in check.
A beloved singer killed. Many people deeply upset by this. I think of Sufi singers, kawals, and I think of the late, great Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. I mean, if Amjad Sabri can be killed, how are Sufis in Pakistan feeling generally right now?
That's exactly it. I mean, this is as high profile as you can get as a Qawwali singer. And if someone on that caliber, on that level, can be killed in broad daylight the way that he was actually on his way to a performance, many Sufis are saying, well, how safe are we? How safe are our shrines? But actually, it then brings up a bigger question about, you know, minorities in general, not just Sufis, but what about Christians? What about Ahmadis? Remember, this attack came as the latest in a spate of attacks in Karachi. It's a really, really tragic event, but it's not isolated. It comes in a trend of violence that is happening now in Karachi and that is throwing up a number of questions about what the security forces are doing there. Remember that Karachi itself has been under a military operation for a number of years now. The Rangers, or the paramilitary forces, have taken the reins of security there. And while many will tell you that it did curb the militants and push them back, that we still see these criminal acts happening. And unfortunately, a very, very high profile assassination in Amjad Sabri's death.
My BBC colleague Shaima Khalil in Islamabad, thank you very much for your time today, Shaima.
Thanks for having me.
Music from the late Amjad Sabri there. For schools across this country, it's that time of year when classes come to an end and they let out a lot of happy teenagers. Or is that an oxymoron? Anyway, students are glad the summer is here because, let's face it, high school can be tough. New classes, new people, and for some students, a whole new country. There are thousands of international students who enroll each year in private high schools in the U.S., and that can bring on some serious culture shock. Daniel Gross has our story from a school on Cape Cod.
Cape Cod Academy is located in one of the least diverse parts of Massachusetts. There are hardly any Asians there, but that all changes in the school's hallways. This group of students is chatting in Mandarin. Tony Zhang comes from Guiyang, a city in southern China. I ask him about his first day here.
I had no idea that I had to wear a collared shirt.
He didn't have the right clothes, and he had a haircut, a mullet, that some kids thought was strange.
I had no friends for the first couple of weeks.
Tony isn't like a lot of teenagers, not because of the mullet, but because he chose a high school nearly 8,000 miles from home.
I basically went around the globe and tried to figure out which place is better for my future. So UK, Australia, Europe, Japan, but I felt like here's my future, here's where my answer is.
Tony wanted to experience a new culture and go to college in the U.S. He says the move forced him to grow up.
You are in charge of everything that you own. Your money, your cell phone, your study, your future.
Cape Cod Academy started enrolling Chinese students 5 years ago. This year, there are 27. And 70 students in China applied for just 5 spots in the next freshman class. But coming here takes money. Tony's school in China was inexpensive. By contrast, there's the sticker price for Cape Cod Academy.
About $45,000 to $50,000 a year.
That's Alexandra Talicious, the school's head of admissions. The fee for international students is higher because they pay for a host family, student visa, and ESL classes. Talicious says the legacy of China's one-child policy convinces parents to do what it takes to invest in their kids.
It's not just the uber wealthy anymore. We used to see a lot of CEO children, but now we see families with incomes that aren't quite so high. So they sacrifice, 60-70% of their incomes to send their children here.
When Catherine Zhao got here from Beijing, it took her a while to get used to small town Cape Cod. There are no skyscrapers and everybody drives.
What's the biggest challenge for you?
Talk. Because in China, we learn English, we learned in class. We know how to write, how to read, but there's not too much opportunities to talk.
There's homesickness, too. Some students Skype with their parents every day. Tony also talks about the stereotypes he and other Chinese students face here.
I would say they, in general, think us we're math genius, science genius. So they may just think like we're nerds that know nothing besides study. But, to be honest, we are human beings as well, so we play sports. Another thing is, when they see us writing Chinese, they would be like, oh my God, how can you even do that to communicate in such a complicated language? To be honest, they don't have, much understanding about what is China like now.
Realizing that is part of life here for Tony and his Chinese classmates. And so is eating American-style Chinese food. It's noon, so I head with Tony and Catherine to lunch. And as it turns out, there's Chinese food on the menu.
We have some fried rice, orange chicken, and a lot of extra beef teriyaki and crab rangoons.
Are you hungry at all looking at this, or not? Not really?
Not really.
What about you? Do any of this look good to you?
I would say I would only take the fried rice.
Catherine doesn't seem to mind, though. She's taking the long view and hopes to study piano at Boston's Berklee School of Music. Tony wants to major in economics and education at Brown University. After, he says, he wants to go back to China and work on the education system there. For The World, Daniel Gross, Osterville, Massachusetts.
Potentially historic times in Britain. A nationwide referendum is going to determine if the UK stays in the European Union or leaves. For Scots, it's the second big referendum in as many years. Remember 2014? Scotland decided pretty conclusively to remain a part of Britain. One big factor for Scottish voters then, the UK was part of the EU, and it wasn't clear Scotland would have to rejoin the EU as an independent country. So if the UK votes to leave, many Scots will be upset. There's even been talk of another Scottish independence referendum if the Brexit happens. So to get a sense of how Scots are feeling, we called up comedian Janie Godley in Glasgow. I asked her if the Brexit campaign's been different north of the border.
I think it's definitely been a different campaign because it's the first time that people like me, and I give you a background, people like me are SNP, we're Scottish nationalists, we wanted independence, but we're also socialists. And it's the first time ever I have agreed with a Tory, the Conservative Party who are in power in London. We don't normally agree with anything. We don't even like breathing the same air as them, but they also agree. So we've got the Tories agreeing. We've got the Labour Party, most of them agreeing. Not all the Tories, but the majority of the Tories. Tories in Scotland. The Tory leader, Ruth Davidson, has agreed to remain. So the whatever Tories there is in Scotland want to remain. You've got the SNP remaining. You've got Labour remaining. So it looks like it will be a big cross-party remain. And it's one of the first times we've all been joined in the one boat, so to speak. But I don't think statistically there's still enough of us to tip that boat in the favour.
So when you think about the UK doing the Brexit, leaving the EU, what occurs to you in Scotland's future? What does that world look like?
I don't want to leave Europe. I love the fact that we've got, you know, the immigration has been the elephant in the Bremen campaign office. So, you know, people don't want to deal with the problems of immigration. I think that immigration has been absolutely handled very well from a Scottish perspective. We were the first people to take as many Syrians in. And, you know, people are worried about jobs. There's 2.5 million people who are employed in the UK as a direct result of our EU trade. So we have that as well. And I don't want to see trade and business. Our membership of the EU means every business in the country, from the corner shop right up to the trade market, 500 million people across 28 countries. It's very important to remain in the EU. To me, there's an undercurrent vibe that the Brexit campaign have run, which was based on basically racism and immigration, putting up posters of thousands and hundreds of thousands of immigration standing at the border. You know, last night, Marco, my dad got taken into hospital in Glasgow. He's fine, but people keep saying that there isn't enough hospital beds. There wasn't enough hospital beds last night, but that's because four drunk Scottish white people were fighting all over the corridor, and the swarms of immigrants that we were worried about were actually tending and caring to my dad. So I am all for remain.
They were the nurses and the orderlies, huh?
Yes, they were the doctors, and not just the orderlies. They were the doctors and the nurses. Over here, we don't have orderlies fight with the drunks. The doctors and nurses are very hands-on.
So what will the people of Scotland say if the UK decides to leave the EU? And do you think there will be another Scottish referendum on independence if that happens?
Do you know something, Marco, that I've just realised, and I got a whiff of this today? There are going to be some Scottish people who are going to vote exit, so that we will be forced into a referendum. There is tactical voting going on. There is a lot of people who have contacted me on Facebook who are pretty high up there in the political circles and saying, we're going to vote exit. And I'm like, why? They're like, well, because if Scotland gets booted out of Europe, the next referendum, we've got a safe boat home. So you have that application coming into the mix as well.
If the vote is close on Brexit, it's pretty conceivable that the huge amount of support in Scotland could be the decisive factor, the rainmaker in keeping Britain within the EU. If that happens, what about the rest of the UK? Could they be resentful towards Scotland for keeping them in?
I don't think there's enough people. You've got to remember, the whole of Scotland doesn't even match the whole of London's population. There isn't that many of us. We've got a lot of mountains, dude. Not a lot of people live up there. We've not got a huge population. So we're at the top of the boat. I don't think we can tip it. We don't have a big enough population to be able to do that.
So very clear, you want to stay in the EU.
I absolutely want to stay. The UE funds equality. They fund discrimination. They fund women's economics. The Brits, the British farmers would go out without the support of the EU. We have got a lot of reasons to stay in. And I am definitely I'm a European. I'm a Scottish European. I've got so many identities. I'm British, I'm Scottish, and I'm European. And I'm a woman. And I'm a stand-up comedian. And I'm a Glaswegian. So it's all there.
Finally, Janie, let me just ask you, what are your thoughts on the word Brexit? Because to me, it sounds like the sound of someone with a bad tummy ache, but maybe a better word might have helped the Leave voters.
Yeah, it sounds like a really odd, deviant sexual position.
I wasn't expecting that, but yeah.
You weren't, but there you go. So the next time you hear somebody saying, do you want to go for a Brexit? Say no, dude, just say no. Say no, unless it involves mountains and walking. I'm not going.
Janie Godley, good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Let's get back briefly to the Brexit vote in the UK. I was surprised to learn today that if Britain does decide to quit a united Europe, it won't be the first time. Of course, I learned this from The World's history guy, Chris Wolfe. So, Chris, what was this first Brexit? It's got to be some time ago.
That's right, Marco. We're going way back in the mists of time to 286 AD, to be precise.
That's Roman times, right?
That's right. Most of Europe is united under the Roman Empire, and Britain enjoys all the benefits of free trade and a single currency. There's free movement of people, and of course there's Roman roads and sanitation, justice and security.
Sounds pretty good. So why would the Britons, the ancient Britons, want to leave the empire?
Well, primarily, it's a tale of personal politics and individual survival. There was this really interesting cat called Carausius. Now, if you're a Game of Thrones fan, he reminds me of Sir Davos Seaworth, the lowborn sailor who claws his way up into the nobility and to high military command purely based on his abilities. And so he became admiral of the fleet based in Britain. And Carausius also was a favorite of the emperor. He saved his butt, the emperor's butt, in a battle in Gaul a little bit earlier.
Mm. So it's Carausius who decides to kind of come up with this idea of a, you know, ancient Roman Brexit.
Yes, it was. He didn't really have much choice, really. Although he was Emperor Maximian's favorite naval commander, Carausius was found guilty of corruption. Maximian ordered him to be executed. And rather than submit, he declared himself Emperor of Britannia. Seems like a logical choice. But he's a pretty unlikely champion of British independence. One writer, Alan Clayson, has called him a probable hybrid of Al Capone, Idi Amin, and Long John Silver.
Yowza, and people followed a guy like that?
Well, yeah, he really was smart enough to appeal to its native British dissatisfaction with the Roman Empire. It wasn't all bread and circuses. There was a lot of unhappiness with taxes and overregulation from the continent. Sounds familiar. but anyway, Carausius was not a true Roman. He was what they call a Romanized Celt with strong local ties on either side of the English Channel. So it's not clear if he was exploiting Celtic nationalism in some way. But from the coins he issued, we know he was really good at propaganda. One of them had the big slogan, Liberty. It's like he's trying to convince people that he's trying to fight for freedom. He also had coins that said things like Restorer of Britain and Spirit of Britain, you know, and he had other coin stressing his Roman culture, so he's kind of trying to play both sides, but clearly he was trying to pander to the local feelings.
Well, real echoes of the present day. So Carausius leads Britannia in the first Brexit. Are there any lessons about how it went that we might kind of consider today?
Well, probably not. Unlike Brussels, the Emperor of Rome was determined and able to try and crush the rebellion by force. But this is where I think there are some parallels. Thanks to geography, Carausius and his successor are able to hold out for 10 years. So I think one lesson might be this is how geography plays a role. You know, the nature of Britannia being an island helped people think that they are able to go it alone.
What happened to Carausius himself?
Well, in keeping with the Game of Thrones meme, he's murdered by his internal enemies 7 years later. And he was replaced by his finance minister, a guy called Alectus, who was much more of a proto-nationalist. He dropped all this veneer of Roman stuff, and he was very much more about the local pride. He survived another 3 years till the Romans were able to sneak an army past his navy to invade Britain itself, and he was killed in battle outside of London. Now, it's interesting that after taking Londinium, the new emperor immediately struck new coins to replace the ones saying Liberty, and they said his name and the phrase Restorer of the Eternal Light, meaning the eternal light and power of Rome.
Right. Bye-bye Brexit number one.
Exactly. It'll be interesting to see what new coins the Brits will be minting after tomorrow.
Yeah. Make Londinium great again? The World's History Guy, Chris Wolf. That's fascinating stuff. Thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
Finally today, a great underdog story. Iceland, tiny Iceland, won big at the Euro 2016 soccer tournament yesterday. And in dramatic fashion, the Icelanders ran the length of the field to score a goal in the last seconds of a match against Austria. Here's Icelandic sports announcer Gudmundur Benediktsson with the call. Wow, I have no idea what he's saying, but I'm getting Vikingish chills just listening to that. If you want even more Icelandic excitement, check out the Reykjavik Grapevine Twitter feed. The man behind that is John Rogers. John, how are you feeling right now about Iceland's soccer team?
Yeah, it's been a crazy week for Icelandic football. I mean, the atmosphere in Reykjavik right now has been crazy. Everyone has face paints, flags, there's people banging drums in the streets. And after that particular goal, there was like an impromptu carnival in Reykjavik, to be honest.
Now, your Reykjavik Grapevine Twitter feed is kind of capturing the moment-by-moment excitement of all this. The time of smiting Austria, it says in all caps, into the jaws of oblivion on our march to certain victory is nigh. That's pretty intense. What other things have you been writing on your feed?
Now we smite them into a million pieces with the mighty hammer of Thor and all this kind of stuff, which, you know, it's a big part of the Icelandic history, the sagas and the storytelling and the culture from like the 800s through to the, you know, the next 500 years or so. So, I mean, it does belong to Icelandic culture, but Iceland's obviously a modern country, so there's an element of parody to it as well.
And I gather Icelanders are even offering up sacrifices to the Icelandic gods Odin and Thor, really?
That's right. Well, that was another joke that came on the Twitter, like, please lay up your offerings, like Thor likes some mead and meat as an offering.
So but is it happening for real?
We got hundreds of people tweeting back at us with pictures of their defrosting pork chops and and shots of whiskey. So people were making offerings, yes.
Wow.
We even got a live baby in one offering.
Oh, my. Wow. That's got to be a joke. Although during Euro 2016, you never really know.
Yeah, after that last goal, I'm not sure if we should follow up on that one.
So Iceland's in the final round of 16 and facing England. John, you're English. You've been in Iceland for a while. I presume you love it there. Kind of a dilemma for you, isn't it? They play England on Monday.
Yeah, I mean, I've supported the English team since I was a boy. I remember watching Gary Lineker and Paul Gascoigne in the Italian World Cup and cheering for them. But, I mean, this is my adopted homeland, and so I don't think I'm really going to know where my heart is on this until the first whistle blows.
Right. Well, as I said, that's Monday. Iceland is already planning on a win. And as a consolation prize for the English side, a tourism company in Reykjavik, I gather, has made a generous offer. What is it?
That's right. A local whale-watching company has printed 23 special tickets so that when we defeat England, the sad players can come and cheer themselves up by going to see some Icelandic whales.
Well, all I can say is, Wayne Rooney, watch out for that blowhole.
Exactly. Quite.
John Rogers, the man behind the Reykjavik Grapevine Twitter feed. All I got to say is good luck to Iceland, man.
Thanks a lot.
Going to mambo my way out of here, and that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.